Today we're going to take a look at Daniel, Ezekiel, and eschatology, because both of these books, Daniel and Ezekiel, have a lot of future things in them, a lot of prophecy. So that's the thread we're going to follow today. A little preview is this. We're going to take a look at how Daniel predicted Palm Sunday, how we know that Daniel loved Deuteronomy. He was a man of God, so he had to love Deuteronomy. Number three, which road to Jerusalem God always takes. It's an interesting path as you take a look throughout history and watch it. And number four, why the folks at Pentecost had flames on their heads. It's a very good Old Testament reason that we find in the message today. So here's where we want to start with eschatology. What in the world is it good for? You can make some very cool and complex charts. When I was growing up, my dad used to draw things like this in Sunday school, of all the covenants in God's big program, or the book of Revelation. You know, it looked like this, and you're taught that if you could master that, you were a spiritual person. But it's really not what eschatology is good for. And actually, it's for arguing with the believers about until most people are mad, the rest are disillusioned, and unbelievers are ignored. No, wait, that's not it. How about this one? Encouraging believers that God will win the battle when it sometimes appears that he, or we, have lost heart and given up. And last time we were together on Monday, we talked about the sandbox, and I hope that that was silly enough that you will remember it and recognize that even though we were being a little bit silly, that there was 95% of that was absolutely true, that there was a lot of discouragement about is God weak? Has God given up? Has he gone somewhere and taken a vacation? Where is God now? And it's during those kind of times that you really need this extra dose that eschatology brings, that God knows the future and God has it all planned out and it's going to work out. And God knows that and he's not giving up, even though it may appear to be so in the immediate future. So here's where we want to start. Oops, right there. On page 144, you've got this chart, and what you can see immediately from the chart is simply that in chapters 2 and 7 and 8 and even beyond in chapter 11, there's this fairly coherent story that God repeats over and over in different ways to make sure you get it. And the basic idea is that as you begin at the top and move down, you're moving down through history, and that there will be a succession of kings or kingdoms that will come, but eventually God's kingdom will come and overthrow all of them. On the left-hand side, which is chapter 2, you got this head of gold, and the materials in the statue decrease in value until you get down to the legs of iron. And in terms of a monarchy, Nebuchadnezzar's head of gold was the purest and strongest and best form of government, I suppose, in terms of its own power. As you move down, you get more brittle. And finally, you get down here, not only to the legs of iron, which is a reference to Rome, but then also to the feet, which are made of clay and iron mixed together and actually has 10 toes. And the 10 toes are symbolic of an end-time kingdom that comes out of that Roman Empire. Now, there's a huge gap between the legs of iron and the toes, okay? There are other kingdoms that come in there, but the point is that there's going to be a series of them, and then eventually the way chapter 2 finishes is this rock comes out of nowhere, not made by human hands, that it's not a human government, and it hits the statue and destroys it, turns all into dust, and this rock goes into a huge mountain, and the mountains in scripture are significant of political kingdoms. It becomes God's kingdom, right? So God will come and destroy all these other kingdoms, and he will reign. Same thing happens in chapter 7. You've got these various animals, a lion, a bear, a leopard, and then this terrifying and frightening beast. And this frightening beast is not simply Rome, but also revived Rome, or the 10-nation confederation that comes out of Rome, and it has 10 horns, again, like the 10 toes, symbolic of the 10 nations that come together that form the Antichrist kingdom. And of course, at the end of chapter 7, this beast is destroyed, and Christ comes back, and there's this beautiful passage in Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14 and 15, where a son of man comes up to the one sitting on the throne, the Ancient of Days, and power and authority is given to him, and he destroys the kingdoms. It's absolutely parallel to what goes on in Revelation 4 and 5, and we'll go into it now, but this is the basis for that kind of thing. It even goes on, let me just tell you one more thing. in Daniel chapter 11. In Daniel chapter 11, there is history that's given, at least from Daniel's time as prophecy, but we look back on it as history. From Daniel chapter 11 all the way through verse 35. If you have a study Bible, you can see the historical references and figures and people that are spoken of, and even the movements of armies in Daniel 11, 1 to 35, that are spoken of here. At one point in time, I had to memorize them in seminary, and I could tell you all of them. I've since forgotten them. I just use my study Bible now, and you can too. All right? But the point is that the prophecy corresponds with history all the way up to the historical figures, so you get to a guy who is a really bad guy, and his name is Antiochus Epiphanes. He is a Greek general who considers himself to be God, actually. That's why he took on the name Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphany means an appearance of God, so he's a very humble character. I am Antiochus, the appearance of God. Now, the Jewish people had a different name for him. They called him Epimenes, a pun on the name. Epimenes means the insane. Right? So they call him Antiochus the insane. He thought he was Antiochus God. And what he does is he actually comes and he tries to make the Jews not keep the law, doesn't let them circumcise their children, won't let them worship on the Sabbath, and he sacrifices a pig on the altar, and he causes such an abomination that the Jewish people can't use the altar in the temple for 3.5 years, and it's called an abomination which causes desolation. And if you have any biblical background, you say, well, that rings some bells like from Revelation, and it's supposed to, because he goes in and he desecrates the temple, and it's not used for 3.5 years. And then at the end of that 3.5 years, the Jewish people, in the form of the Maccabees, that's the family name, rise up and they cleanse the temple, and they don't have enough oil to light the lamps. They don't have enough oil for one day, but they light the lamps, and miraculously, or so the legend goes, I guess it's true, I don't know, the oil lasts for 8 days, and this is where the festival lights, Hanukkah, comes from. Right? Now, this is all historical, but the interesting thing is this is told of in Daniel 11, 1-35, and it finishes with Antiochus Epiphanes, and then verse 36 on, there is no historical reference for the next 10 or 11 verses. And I think what's happening, most Bible scholars agree, is that God is telling history ahead of time up to Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes actually ends up being a foreshadowing of the Antichrist, because he will do the very same thing. They're going to the temple, proclaim himself to be God, and take over. But from verse 36 on, now all of a sudden we're moving off into the future and speaking about the Antichrist. So in all of this, not only chapter 11, but in all of this, God says, here's the way things are going to turn out, and he gives us enough information to go for the next 400 years or so. And then there's a huge gap until you get to the final kingdom of the Antichrist. But the idea is, if in fact the first 400 years are fulfilled literally, and God is absolutely right about how this turns out, then you can trust him for the end of it as well. So if you look at a lot of the eschatology in here, a lot of the big idea is simply this: the future is merely history to God, and his word will become reality. And that's the encouragement that he gives to Daniel back here, as Daniel's looking at this and the temple is smashed, and Daniel thinks, you know, is God weak or is God given up? And the answer is no. I mean, for a time, in fact, for a long time, things are not going to be as you want them to be, but they will be eventually in the end. So that's the big idea from Daniel chapters 2 and 7 and 8 and 9. And here is where it really gets hairy, all right? So if you look in your notes on page 144, I want to get down to the bottom where it talks about the prophecy of the 70 weeks. Yeah, question? All right, so here's where we're going. I want to go down to the 70 weeks of Daniel, or as they're often called from the King James, because the Hebrew word for week actually is simply a kind of a general seven. And so in most contexts, when you talk about a group of seven, you're talking about a group of 7 days. When Daniel uses it, he's talking about a group of 7 years. So his 70 weeks are really 70 groups of 7 years, turns out to be 490 years. Right? So then, anyway, that's where we're headed, to take a look at Daniel's 70 weeks or 490 years. And here's the context. Right? Daniel chapter 9. You don't have to open up your Bible here. You can just take a look at the screen. In the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, in the first year of his reign, which is 536 B.C., right? Over here in Jerusalem, remember, the temple was destroyed in 586, and so we're talking about 50 years later now, over here in 536. Now, a couple of the dates I probably should tell you about is that this, even before Babylon destroyed Jerusalem in 586, for 20 years before that, like in 605 or 19 years before that, they had deported an awful lot of the Jewish people, and Daniel was one of those who had gone. So Daniel, from 605 to 536, is like 69 or 70 years, okay? So Daniel finds himself over here, an old man, 70 years after the first deportation from Israel. And here's what he says. I, Daniel, understood from the scriptures according to the word of the Lord given to Jeremiah the prophet. So he's reading in the book of Jeremiah, in chapter 25, if you want to find it, you know, later for yourself. Jeremiah chapter 25, that the desolation of Jerusalem would last 70 years. So he's saying, okay, we were first destroyed or first taken away in 605. It's 536. 70 years have gone by. And evidently, it's time for us to return. So, verse 3, I turned to the Lord God and pleaded with him in prayer and petition and fasting, sackcloth and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God and I confessed. Now, if it were me and if it were you and you read in the prophet that this, it was only going to last 70 years, instead of saying, so, I turned to the Lord and God pleaded with him, it would read, so, I turned and packed my bags and got ready to go. Right? Why is it that instead of packing his bags, he starts confessing his sin? Why does he do that? Please? Because the sin was what caused the exile in the first place, and you've got to repent in order to get back. David? Because that's a script in Deuteronomy. Exactly. Take a look at it right here. Right? Deuteronomy 30. He's read Deuteronomy 30. Again, this is part of the being cued at the beginning, saying this is why he loved Deuteronomy, because he knew it. I mean, he knew it, and he knew exactly what it took. And so, as it says, when all these blessings and cursings I've set before you come upon you, and you take them to the Lord your God, take them to heart where the Lord your God disperses you among the nations, and when you, your children, return or repent and obey him with all your heart, verse 3, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes. So what he's saying is the condition upon which we're going to get back is not simply, you know, finishing up the 7 years of time, but also finishing up the 7 years of time and then repenting. So he does what everybody else is supposed to do, and he gets down and he confesses his sin and says, God, it's not just me, it's everybody, all of us have sinned against you, and God, would you please restore us? All right, so he's reading here in Deuteronomy 30, and it's not simply a repopulation of the people back to the land that he's looking for. And we know that because of what the next passage says. Even if you've been banished to the most distant land under the heavens, from there the Lord your God will bring you back. He will bring you to the land that belonged to your fathers, and you'll take possession of it. He will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. All right, so whatever glory there was back here during David and Solomon's time, we're going to exceed that. Now, if you know the way history goes, you realize that when they came back under Ezra and Nehemiah, they didn't have that kind of glory. Things were really, really sad. We're going to talk about that more on Friday and Monday. When they got back here, God's presence wasn't in the temple. They didn't have a Davidic leader, right? Zerubbabel is a royal, but he's not sitting on the throne. And it really is very, very discouraging. This is why Ezra and Nehemiah have a hard time getting the people to worship. God didn't even live in the house. But Daniel's over there thinking, okay, when we go back to the land, we're going to be prosperous and numerous, more numerous than our fathers. Things are going to be great, and he will circumcise your hearts, that the whole nation is going to love God from the inside out, and this is going to be it, and all the promises we've been looking forward to since Genesis 3 or Genesis 12 are going to happen, right? That we're going to come back here, we're going to have the land, there's not going to be any curse on it, we're going to have a whole nation who loves God, and our leader is going to come and rule over everything. So he's looking for the fulfillment of all the promises based on Deuteronomy chapter 30. Now, from his perspective over here, I don't think he's wrong to do that, because as you read Deuteronomy chapter 30, you think that's what's going to happen. But he, just like Moses, wasn't thinking about all the valleys in between the mountaintops, right? So, here's what happens. He confesses his sin for 19 verses, and then he says this: while I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin, the sin of my people, Israel, and making my request to the Lord my God for his holy hill, an angel comes and says to him this: as soon as you began to pray, an answer was given, which I have come to tell you. And here's the basic answer given by the angel. The angel says to him, I am so sorry to have to tell you this, Daniel, but that restoration you think is about to happen from Deuteronomy 30, it's not going to happen just yet. Right, so here's the way I would say it. The immediate restoration to the land in 536, when the people go back after these 70 years of exile, is not the full restoration of Deuteronomy 30. In fact, the full Deuteronomy 30 restoration will not happen for at least 70 times 7, 490 more years. Now, you're going to go back to the land, there's no doubt about it. People are going to go back, they're going to repopulate it, but it's not the full return, the full restoration you're looking for. There's going to be a number of fulfillments or foreshadowings until you get there. All right? So, stay with me, and let's picture it, okay? As I picture it, it's going to look something like this. 536 is the first return. And stay with me here, Joe, stay with me, okay? 33 is going to be the next big mountaintop. This is going to be, of course, when Messiah comes, right? And then I'm going to put 2013 up here. A lot of people are confused about this. The reason why I put 2013... maybe I should have put 2012, right? But I'm thinking 2012 AD or 2013. Thinking about the second coming of Christ, because if in fact there is a 7-year tribulation, right? If Jesus comes back in the rapture and then there's 7 more years of tribulation, what's the earliest date the second coming could be? 7 years from now, 2012, 2013, something like that, okay? So these are the big dates here that I think you have to keep in mind with these 70 weeks of Daniel, because here's what we're going to say. This return, immediate return in 536 is not really the ultimate one. It's kind of a shadow, right? We're going to kind of fade it out because people are going to come back to land, but it's not going to be the full restoration we're looking for. Could it happen in 33 when Messiah comes? Well, as it turns out, it's not going to be then. The ultimate return is not going to happen until at least here. Now, obviously, Daniel didn't know the dates 2013. But there are at least 3 significant dates here that these 490 years or 77s are going to bring up in our minds. Now, let me explain to you how I get this. All right. So here's where we go. The immediate restoration of land is not the full restoration. Deuteronomy 30, restoration is not going to happen until here or here. Now, let's take a look then at verses 24 and 25 and 26 and 27 and see how the angel explains this to Daniel. Here we go. Verse 24. 77s, or 70 groups of 7 years, or 490 years, are decreed for your people and your holy city to do 6 things: to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now, these are all the things that Daniel is hoping for right here in 536, okay? He's reading Deuteronomy 30, he's thinking, oh boy, I can't wait for all that stuff to happen. And the angel says, no, not quite yet. It's going to take a span of 490 years for all that stuff to happen. Now, when does some of that stuff actually start to happen? When, for example, do you suppose wickedness is going to be atoned for? Yeah, exactly. A lot of this stuff is not going to happen until here, when Calvary happens. But some of it, like to seal up vision or prophecy, when is prophecy going to end? Prophecy's not going to end eventually until here. So a lot of this stuff is going to take place over a period of time. Right? There's going to be at least the first coming of Messiah and even a second coming for all of this stuff to happen. It's not going to happen immediately in 536 here. Right? So, let's take a look and see when it is. Because some of you notice that if you start back here in Daniel's day, 536, and you go up here to 33, how many years have you got? You're like 560-some, right? There's a lot more than 490. So how do you get this 490 years? Well, here's how you do it. Verse 25. No one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now that decree that goes out by Artaxerxes happens in 445 B.C. And I'm going to put a number of numbers up here. And I wasn't very careful when I made this thing up. I didn't always put B.C. or A.D. on them, so you should know. This is 445 B.C. If you also need some help, you can look on page 146, and we try to cover the same kind of thing. You're going to see that explained in a chart in a different way. Right? But for right now, take a look at this. From the issue of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed when the ruler comes. Now, anointed one. Hebrew phrase, or there is a Hebrew phrase for anointed one. Yeah, you remember what it is? Messiah, right? So from 445 B.C. until Messiah comes, and Messiah comes right here, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. Right? Or seven groups of 7 years, which is 49 years. And then there will be 62 groups of sevens, which turns out to be 483 years, okay? I'm not sure why it breaks it up that way. Maybe the first 49 takes 49 years to get the city rebuilt. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, it breaks up that way. So you got seven sevens and 62 sevens for a total of 69 groups of seven, right? Or how many years would that be? Now, seven times 70 is 49, and take away seven, you end up with 483, okay? Now, the trick is that as you take a look at this, 483 years, again, even 43 doesn't go from 445 B.C. to 33 A.D. because these people did not count years as 365 and a quarter days as we do. They counted them as 360-day years. Now, I haven't done this, but I know somebody who has. If you look on page 146, there's a bibliography at the bottom. And you see a book there written by a fellow named Harold Honer, who is the director of doctoral studies at Dallas Seminary. And he writes this book, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ. Now, I read that book once, and I'm glad I read it once. I don't ever want to read it again. It's not the kind of thing you really enjoy reading. It's kind of like reading through an encyclopedia. But he goes through all of this amazing chronology, and he's very persuasive. It's the kind of book you read and you say, I would never, ever want to write that. You know, it's hardly enough to read it, but I'm glad somebody did look into this. And so he did, and what he says is that if you take the 360-day years and you account for leap years and leap centuries and you put all that stuff together, that it turns out that Messiah actually comes on March 29th, 33 A.D., which is the date of the triumphal entry. So that you start with the edict from 445, you get 483 of these 360-day years down to the very day when Messiah proclaims himself to be Messiah as he gets on the donkey, which is a very symbolic thing because that's what Solomon did. Solomon got on a little donkey and rode into town on the day he was coronated. So the first son of David did it and the second son of David does it, and he presents himself as Messiah on that day. And I really think that if you are careful and if you understand and you live in this time, you can actually count down the days and know when he's going to come. So I think this is what Jesus is talking about when he says in Luke chapter 19, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. Because, of course, on the day of the triumphal entry, they only give him a very superficial welcome, not a real welcome. If it had been a true welcome, they wouldn't have changed their minds and in 5 days crucified him. Right? Now, we know this is true, not only because Daniel says so, but Harold Horner helps explain it, and we also know because you can read comics, which teach you the very same thing. This comic came out about 5 years ago on Palm Sunday, and it is entitled The Prophecy Which Very Few Knew, and I think that's a good description. About 500 years before Jesus was born, make that 500 B.C., an angel named Gabe told a prophet named Dan just how many days it would be. From the edict to rebuild Jerusalem, till Messiah the king would ride through its gates, came out to a 173,880-day wait. Generations of faithful descendants would cross off the days as the years dwindled down, till the final day came, and as Dan had proclaimed, guess who rode into that town? Biblical prophets did not make a killing. They always were able to get work, because they averaged 100% in fulfilling. Try that with your psychic friends network. And you know, the author of the cartoon gets it exactly right. The day of the triumphal entry, March 29th, is in fact fulfillment to the very day of these 483-360-day years. So, what happens here? Well, notice what happens in verse 26. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off. Cut off, again, is Old Testament shorthand for what? He'll be killed, right? He will be killed. So he is killed here on April 3rd, 33 AD. Crucifixion happens, and it says he will have nothing. Why? Because in the context of Daniel, every time the final kingdoms are destroyed, it's set up with God's kingdom, and Jesus here does not have a kingdom. He comes, he's killed, and he doesn't get the kingdom. So he has nothing. Now, notice also that it says after the 62 sevens. It's talking about after the 62 sevens here, which seems a little odd because you would expect it to be in the middle or at the beginning of the 70th week, but it's not. It says after the 62, implying that there's a gap of time between here and here. You with me on this? That's, I think, what the word after implies. So let me talk about the next verse, and then we'll take a second for some questions, okay? So after the 62 sevens, you know, we'll have nothing, be cut off and have nothing. And then it says this, the people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, we know the city and the sanctuary are destroyed here in 70 AD. By Rome. They come in and destroy it, and Masada's destroyed then too, and what we find out here then is this, that the ruler who will come, therefore, is going to come out of this people, will come out of ancient Rome, or the revived Roman Empire. So they will destroy the city and sanctuary, and it will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. Now, this whole time period in this gap, we don't know how long it is. But Daniel does say that somewhere in that gap, you know, after Messiah dies and after Jerusalem is destroyed, there are going to be lots and lots of desolations. Now, nothing could be more true about the nation of Israel. When you take a look at the Jewish people after 70 AD and you try to write their history, guess what it is? It's like, where did they live? Anywhere but Israel. They were running from their enemies and being persecuted and destroyed by the Roman Catholic Church and everybody, and not till 1948 did they finally get a home of their own. And desolations certainly have happened to them until it comes time for the end, right? So let's take a look at the end here. Then he, not Messiah, but the ruler who will come. So in this book, we're talking about the Antichrist. The Antichrist, then, will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. So we're talking about this last final group of 7 years. The book of Revelation calls it tribulation period. So this one last group of 7 years here will start when the Antichrist confirms a covenant with many for a group of 7 years. Now, the many, probably talking about Jewish people and Arab people, Palestinians, perhaps Muslim world and Jewish world. It's going to take a one world leader to try to bring the whole thing together. Jimmy Carter tried to do it, and Bill Clinton tried to do it, and everybody's tried to do it, and nobody's going to get it done until this guy comes and actually accomplishes it. And then it says this, on a wing of the temple he will set up an abomination that causes desolation in the middle of the seven. So he's going to pick up where that character Antiochus Epiphanes left off, and he's going to go into the temple and proclaim himself to be God, and it's going to be such an abomination that the whole thing will be desolate and not be able to be used. And that will happen for the next 3.5 years until the end that is decreed is poured out on him here at the end. And what Daniel's 70 weeks does is lays out a whole time scheme to say, listen, it looks like God has forgotten us, but God knows the program from beginning to end. And I'll tell it to you in miraculous, accurate detail if you want to hear it. and if in fact the first 69 weeks or 483 years are fulfilled to the detail, and then there's a gap in between, you can be sure that this last week is going to happen as well. And when this last group of seven happens, here, Daniel, right here at the very end, is when all of these things you're looking for will happen. Sin will be gone. It'll be totally atoned for. We won't have any more need for prophecy. All that stuff will be over. There will be a group of Jewish people, a nation that loves God with all their heart, that live in the land, that have a leader who rules over them, and in fact rules over the entire world, and all those things we've been looking for since Genesis chapter 3 will finally happen here. And what I'm doing for you, God says to Daniel, is I'm finally giving you a time frame. Now, admittedly, there's a huge gap in here. You don't know how long it is. But if these first 69 happen literally, you can guess that this one will too. All right? Now, let me see what kind of questions I can answer for you. Because my guess is that you may be, depending upon your background, you may say, yeah, I knew that, or you might be a little overwhelmed and might not even know which question to ask.
Am I proposing in 2013
this is all going to happen? Yes, I stake my life. No, just kidding. No, what I'm saying is that it can't happen until 2013 because we still have 7 years until the second coming. I'm distinguishing between second coming and rapture. Okay, if the rapture happens tomorrow, then it has to be 7 years of tribulation, and that takes us up to, you know, December 2012 or 2013, something like that. Right, because we've still got the 70th week. We've still got a 7 year period we have to go through before all this stuff finally happens. So 2013 AD is the first time Jesus could come back to set up his kingdom. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
A little.
A little? Okay. Yeah, Craig?
I'm just hypothetically saying that if it happened tomorrow in 2013.
That's right. I'm just hypothetically saying that that's the earliest date it could happen.
Oh, okay. So, yeah.
Yeah. You really should go through finals and take them seriously. Sorry, if that's what you were hoping for, that's not what I was saying. Heather? I think, according to Revelation, the abomination he sets up in the temple is probably just going to be he goes in and proclaims himself to be God. And, again, that kind of follows along with Antiochus Epiphanes, the appearance of God, what he foreshadowed, and I think that's what he's going to do too. If you read Revelation 17 and 18, you find that the first 3.5 years, there is religious Babylon, this religious one world religious system that's destroyed halfway through. And I think it's destroyed because the Antichrist says, okay, forget about the religious system, now what you're going to worship is me, I am the Christ. And Antichrist means not just someone who's against Christ, but someone who literally is in place of Christ. The Greek preposition anti means in place of, and it's the powerful preposition that's always refers to our atonement. It's a substitutionary atonement. He takes our penalty in place of us. So the Antichrist pretends to be Christ. And my guess is he's going to have a pretty powerful persuasive PR campaign. He's going to say things like, you know, at the midpoint in tribulation, I think again according to Revelation, he's going to die and come back to life. Right? I think what he's going to say is something like, hey, listen, there was this guy 2,000 years ago who claimed to be Messiah. He lived among you for 3.5 years, had a ministry. He died, and then who knows what happened to him. But I've had this ministry with you for 3.5 years. I died. I've come back to life. And guess what? I am your long-awaited Messiah. And it's going to be a very perfect replacement campaign of the true Messiah. And it's going to be very persuasive. An awful lot of people are going to fall down and say, yep, I'm signing up with that guy. Here, put his stamp right here and right here. I'm fully identified with him. Yeah, and that's going to be the abomination that causes desolation.
Isn't there a passage anywhere in the Bible that tells you, that talks about that gap?
Is there a prophecy that talks about the gap?
Yeah.
Good question. There are a lot of places in Scripture that you get hints about it. For example, when Jesus dies and is resurrected and then ministers for 40 days, just before he gets ready to go back to heaven, the burning question on the minds of all the disciples is that they only want to know one thing. In Acts chapter 1, do you remember what it is they want to know? will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Is it going to happen now? And he says to them this very, very unsatisfying answer. He says to them, well, you know what? It's not for you to know the times of the seasons. But you be witnesses unto me in Jerusalem and Judea. And it's really interesting. He says, okay, there's going to be a gap here, and frankly, I'm not telling you how long it's going to be. But that's not your business. You don't need to know the times and the seasons. But they want to know, is it now? Is it now? Is this when it's going to happen? He says, not going to tell you. So there's evidence that people are expecting the kingdom to happen right then. But there's also evidence there's going to be a gap and of an indeterminate time that he won't tell us about. Yeah. Gee, I would have to know God's thinking on the matter. And as much as I pretend to do it, I don't really know it. I guess because, again, it's an awful lot like it was with Abraham, right? Why is it that God led Abraham all that time and never fulfilled the promises for him? It's a journey of faith. It's only in those difficult times of waiting for the hope to be fulfilled that our faith grows we draw closer to him, hopefully. So we can be the kind of people who say, you know, it's been a long time. In fact, it's been my whole life and I haven't seen promises fulfilled, but my faith is stronger today than when I started. Nick? It's not so much in Daniel as it is in Revelation. I'm cheating and using the New Testament here. It talks about a fatal wound from which he recovers. Right. Yeah, Chet.
What's the situation with the Temple Mount? Like, is there a temple there now? Or is it just the
Dome of
Rock?
Oh, yeah, it's a huge political situation with the Temple Mount. And in a few minutes, I'll show you some pictures of that. The Dome of the Rock is built over the very place where the temple was. And that's huge because for Jewish people, you can't just build a temple anywhere. You have to build it in the very same spot.
So, like, because there's going to be the abomination of the temple or whatever.
Right.
And is there any mention that during that time the temple
is
built? Because if not, then we can at least know that the rapture is not
going to
come until the temple's here.
That's true. Although I think if you can imagine, if you really did have an Antichrist who was a one world leader, and he got everybody together. And by the way, I do think that a preacher of rapture makes sense here. That if the rapture does come before the tribulation, I think it will, and you take all those people out of the world, that's going to be an international crisis of unbelievable proportion. Mm-hmm. Where in the world will those people go? What's going on? You know, is heaven and hell happening? What's breaking loose here? And I think under that kind of situation, it's perfectly right for somebody to take control and give leadership. Mm-hmm. And so if you had the whole world together and everybody said, okay, here's what we're going to do, folks. We're going to build a temple. Imagine how fast it could, you know, be done. Mm-hmm. And when he says he will make a covenant with many for 1 week, you get all the world's resources put together. I think you can come up with a temple pretty quick. Do you want a second question?
No.
Nope. Oh, okay. Yeah.
People keep talking like, oh, the signs of the end times is coming, like with the natural disasters and pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And things
mm-hmm.
like that. But if it's not for us to know the times, do you think that there are going to be signs like that? Are those accurate things? Or, like, wouldn't the rapture just happen and then the Antichrist raise to power?
Yeah, I think people get too excited about this in terms of trying to predict it and saying these are end time things are going to happen. But most of those things, wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and stuff, those are things that happen in the tribulation period that are signs of the second coming, not signs of the rapture. So I think when people say, ooh, we know it's not going to happen because we don't see these things happening, I think they're mistaken. The rapture could happen any time, and things could develop very quickly in those seven-year period. Okay, we could probably talk about this all day, but is there anything else you want to ask about this particular part before we go on? Because there's some more stuff I want to show you today before we quit. One more. Ashley?
Didn't you say that Antiochus Epiphanes sacrificed a pig on the altar, and you said that that was also an abomination that caused
Yes.
So could the Antichrist do that?
He could sacrifice a pig, but I think it's going to be even worse than that, simply because there is this really unholy trinity between Satan and the Antichrist and the false prophet, mimicking the true trinity. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that in order to make this claim he is Messiah, he's going to say, hey, here I am. I am God. Mm-hmm. Right? That would be the ultimate abomination. The lie, I think, spoken on the 2 Thessalonians. The lie is the Antichrist is the Christ. All right, so here's where we go. With comparing this to what we've done before, we're going to put it right here on top, because the first four talk to us about who, and then Micah told us the answer to what question? Where in Bethlehem, and Daniel now tells us the answer to what question? When, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so I think that's all I want to tell you about Daniel chapter 9. Let me scoot over here real quickly and talk to you about Ezekiel. When I talk about Ezekiel, I've entitled him the Jeremiah of Babylon, because he's doing the very same thing in Babylon that Jeremiah is doing in Jerusalem. If you remember the message of Jeremiah, just transfer it to Ezekiel. Because, well, let me put it this way. Let's get a little bit of a chronological anchor here and talk about where people are in 597. 597 is critical because there are three deportations from Israel. The first one is in 605. That's when Daniel is taken away from Jerusalem over to Babylon. He and a bunch of the other leading young guys, young people who are used as hostages over there, leave in 605. 597 is the second deportation, and Ezekiel goes with that group. It's not till 586 that Nebuchadnezzar comes back and destroys everything and finally takes the final group of people over. All right, so when you're asking in 597, where are these people? Let me give you a little picture. Jeremiah would be where in 597? Yeah, he's going to be in Jerusalem because he always stays in Jerusalem. Ezekiel is going to be where? In 597, he's in Babylon, and Daniel is... He's already been there for 8 years, and he greets Ezekiel when he comes. And so that's where everybody is here right now in 597. Now, that becomes important because I just want to share with you this quick thread. All right, here is an overview of the capital of Jerusalem. Notice the Mount of Olives over here on the eastern side, this mountain ridge. A huge valley down here called the Kidron Valley. This area out here is the Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem. And this area in here is about the size of 17 football fields. It's actually the temple area, although the temple itself, temple proper, the building is just that little spot right there. Okay? I'll give you a shot of what this looks like from this perspective, looking from the west to the east. Where the temple used to sit, now you see this, as Chet was speaking about it. You can see that area of 17 football fields like around in here, basically. Dome of the Rock sits up this high. The temple actually would have sat up even higher up to here. The Valley of Kidron here and the Mount of Olives all the way across here. Right? So, that's the area I want to zoom in on and I want to share with you about the time when God leaves the temple. Ezekiel records it in chapter 8. He stretched out what looked like a hand and took me by the hair of my head. So there's this angel that comes and grabs him by the hair of the head, so that's how we know he wasn't bald. At least before this, he wasn't bald. And the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and heaven, and in visions of God, he took me to Jerusalem, to the entrance to the north gate of the inner court, which would be about right here. That's the inner court, the northern gate. And he shows me where the idol that provokes to jealousy stood. So they have taken idols and put them here, right in God's temple, as though, you know, one member of the marriage, one spouse brings somebody else home to live. It's like, wait a minute, not in my house. And there before me was the glory of the God of Israel, as I'd seen in the vision I'd seen in the plain. Here's a model of it, and the spot would be right about there if you can connect it with the picture before. All right. Now, I want to give you a view of what this whole area looks like. These are some steps going up to the temple area. I'm going to show you a model of it here. You can see the steps. And then what it actually looks like today. Again, there are the steps, and this is the Al-Aqsa Mosque on top where the temple area used to be. So here's what happens. He said to me, "Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The utterly detestable things the house of Israel is doing here. But you will see detestable things are things that are even more detestable." So I went in and looked, and they're worshiping the creature rather than the creator. So God says, "Listen, if this is what they're going to do in my house, I'm not staying." And the glory of the God of Israel went up from above the cherubim. Now remember where the cherubim are? On what piece of furniture the cherubim sit? The Ark of the Covenant, exactly. And it moved to the threshold of the temple. So he first moves like this. And then notice there's a whole chapter later. Then the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple and stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house, goes out to here. So it's this very reluctant moving out of the house. And then finally, chapter 11, says the cherubim then, verse 23, the glory of the Lord went up from within the city and stopped above the mountain east of it. So it goes out here and goes up from the Mount of Olives. Now, there it goes up and it never ever returns until, fast forward 500 years later, another person of the Godhead shows up in this very spot. Here's what the eastern gate looks like. It's all blocked up here down in the Kidron Valley. It starts right here. And I can't wait to show you where Jesus comes to this place called Bethpage, and on the day of the triumphal entry, he gets in the donkey and he rides in town, follows that path. Right? He is rejected, crucified, and ascends into heaven from, guess where? The Mount of Olives. Zechariah says that when he comes back at the second coming, he's coming back there and walking back up to the temple. Now, that a lot of people know about the prophecy, and so a lot of people have taken this gate here, and this is what they've done to it. Muslims have done this, and you understand what they're doing? They're saying, hey, we're going to try to keep Messiah out. So he comes down, splits the mountain in two, walks up to this and says, oh boy, what do I do now? I don't know. How am I going to get through there? So let me just show you something else real quickly. Right here, along this hillside is what I want to show you. I'm going to show you the site from this area, looking over here at nighttime. Here's what it looks like. Now, see all those little dots? Those are all graves from a whole host of Jewish believers who say, listen, I know he's coming back. I know he's coming back here. And when he comes back and the resurrection happens, I want a front row seat. It's kind of neat, isn't it? Because they know the patterns they follow. Now, when he comes back, there are an awful lot of people who know this prophecy, and some are concerned about it. And many who are concerned about it have done this to this eastern gate right here. Here's what it looks like. It is all blocked up. Muslims have done this because, and they actually put a cemetery here in order to prevent Messiah from coming back. So can you imagine what's going to happen here? He's going to come back and split the mountain in two, walk down the Kidron Valley, get up here and say, oh, by golly, what do I do now? Yeah, okay, maybe a fairly feeble effort to block Messiah from coming. Now, I want to show you this, though. This is the mountain, of course, Mount of Olives, right here. And I want to show you a shot from this side looking at it this way. Because you can imagine that when it comes to real estate, there is really one thing that's important, right? And it is? Three things are important, rather. Location, location, location. Here's what this looks like at nighttime. Now, I don't know if you can make out what this is, but you see all these little blocks over here? All those blocks during the daytime looks like this. See what they are? These are grave sites. You know why? Because over the years, faithful Jewish people have said, hey, when he comes back, I want a front row seat. That's exactly what this is. It's just the result of lots and lots of believing Jewish people who say, I want to be here when it happens because this is the spot where it's going to happen. And the rocks on top, if you remember seeing Schindler's List, but at the end of the movie they have Oscar Schindler's grave, and the people come by and they put rocks on it because that's what you do in Israel. It lasts longer than flowers and they're easier to find. So this this is from relatives who come by to remember the people who were there, rocks on top of the grave. All right. Now, let me say one quick thing. When the day of Pentecost came, they were all together in one place, and suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them. Now, can you put everything together we've talked about here and see why this is so significant? When the Shekinah glory is living in the temple, at least when he was living in the tabernacle, how did you know it? Because there was a pillar of fire on top of it, right? Which meant God was down inside. That Spirit of God leaves in 592. And he never comes back except in the person of Jesus. Jesus walks in, they don't accept him, and so he takes off and he says, listen, I'm leaving because if I leave, I can send you another comforter. So that when you have this, and the Spirit of God comes down, they saw what seemed to be tongues of fire separating and came to rest on each of them, and all of them were filled with the Holy Spirit. What God is saying is, don't you realize that even though the Spirit of God is gone from the temple, He has come back in a different way, in a different place? And that's why Paul says, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your body. So that instead of simply localizing His presence in one building in Jerusalem, now His presence is localized on top of where He indwells New Testament believers to make His name known among the world. So that people who were there would look at it and would be so amazed at what had happened. Instead of having to go to the temple to meet God, all they had to do was recognize He had circumcised their hearts and the Spirit of God was in them, regenerating their own hearts and giving them a new set of desires and motivations and actions to live out and be witnesses and to go places the temple couldn't go. So, there is more to talk about with Ezekiel, but that's about all we have time for today.